Well, good afternoon, guys. I'm a recovered alcoholic. My name's Trevor Long. I'm just going to take this off before I get too warm because I know it's coming. I like to start saying a little prayer. So, God, please set aside everything I think I know about you, about me, about others, about the steps and about the program for an open mind and a new experience of you, of me, of others, of the steps and of the program. And I'd like to start by thanking everyone who's been of service to this meeting for putting it on and giving us all a place to come and eat and the service that you provided. I'm honored to be asked. You know, this has been another example of how I need to continue to lay aside my beliefs and my perceptions because I had this thing in my head that people that get invited to speak for an event like this are prominent known entities or have long durations of abstinence, and you know, I'm just a blip on the radar. That's how I see myself, and in order to have a new experience, I get to go where I'm invited. So I never really know what I'm gonna say when I start out these things. I just kind of grab a couple of picks from the book and roll into it, and that's, I assume God's gonna give me the words. So what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now is I'm sure everyone can identify with that feeling of separation from myself, my brothers and sisters, mankind, the world, everything that I really knew and understood started very young. And I just felt internally uncomfortable as long as I can remember. And, you know, there's some traumatic stuff that happens in some of our childhoods. And that's always given me fuel to seek a solution for. But that's not the thing that made me an alcoholic. It was a valid excuse to stay a victim of my own life. And I had a very angry, rageaholic father and a drug addict mother. Dealt with all the abandonment stuff and, abuse in any form or fashion that you want to label. And again, that gave me a lot of fuel to sit in self-pity. And then when I did find a solution for my problems, I was actually 14 years old, and my mother introduced me to a crystallized form of alcohol and taught me how to smoke it. And that was the first time I ever really had a spiritual experience. Because when I imbibed that substance, what it did is it made me feel a part of. I felt connected and whole. I had an understanding of what normal people must feel like. And so I sought that out, because that was the new solution to me being me. And within a couple of years, I ended up being an IV user and had dropped 30 pounds and, you know, all sorts of stuff that goes along with that. I was actually sitting in an institution and I just thought I was doomed. I never really understood because I didn't feel like anybody else that I knew. I thought I had this sickness that no one could relate to, and I'd probably be better off dead. But an H&I panel came into that facility, and they started using words that I could relate to, and they expressed an internal condition that I thought I was alone in having, and I knew that I had met my people. There were people out there in the world that could relate to the condition that I carried. And so when I left that facility, I started slipping into the rooms of 12-step. And my experience there is I stayed abstinent on mostly meetings and fellowship alone for the better part of 2 years. And it was an uncomfortable time when I was a kid. And no one ever grabbed me and said, "Hey kid, let's find out if you are this thing." Nobody ever rolled out some of those qualifying questions on me. But they were very loving, and they let me be a part of. Maybe they could see something in me that I couldn't even see. And so they didn't bother me too much, but they let me be a part of. And what ended up happening is, after a couple of years, I lost that identification because I'm looking around the room and I'm starting to pick out what separates me from all these people. And I don't relate to someone that's 3-4 decades older and has an alcohol problem. I haven't put a needle in my arm in almost 2 years. I'm not like you. I don't have problems with alcohol. And so I continued to grow up. I stepped away from the rooms and I started drinking. And I hadn't lost control at that point. Now, when I look back in my history, I can see that I had the physical allergy almost from Jump Street. It's taken some years away from that first drink to be able to see that, that once I put it in my body, I lose all control of where the outcome of that evening is going to go. And I didn't realize that. I just thought I was drinking to oblivion every time. I wasn't able to make the connection until recently. But I hadn't crossed the line at that point where I was powerless over whether or not I would take that drink. And it would take me a couple years of drinking to actually cross that line. So I grew up and I got married and to a saint of a woman who got to watch alcoholism develop in full bloom. You know, and as a result of the work we do in these rooms, she's actually one of my best friends today. But we'll circle back to that. A decade of alcoholism developing, I can't handle the world as I'm living in it. And I used to tell my ex-wife that either everyone is just really stupid or I'm the only one that's got all the answers. You know, I didn't get it. I didn't understand. I thought there was something wrong with everyone and everyone else. And it was never me. I never looked at me. And I can't stop drinking, and I'm starting to try because I can feel that it's killing me inside. But it's the only thing that gets me through. You know, I'd leave work halfway through the day, and I'd get a couple of tall cans of 211 at lunch, and I'd try to choke those down and a little bit of dry goods and just so I can tolerate work in the next 3.5 hours. And then as soon as I leave work, you know, it's the same thing. I was always very high functioning. I could always hold a job. I ended up in the building trades. I'm a journeyman glazer. I do high-rise glass work. And when I got into that trade, they told me, kid, you're not a real glazer unless you got two ex-wives and a drinking problem. And I totally respected that because I knew what the bar was. I knew when I would have arrived. And I'm halfway there. I got one ex-wife and a drinking problem. But we got a solution for that problem, so it's all good, right? So the internal condition's just getting to be too much, and the alcohol's not shutting those voices off as it once did. And I start looking at making the final sacrifice because I don't know how else to continue a life that way. And again, I'm looking constantly outside. Everyone else, everything else is the problem. And I'm just feeling disconnected, and I'm tired of doing this day in, day out. I wound up being institutionalized twice in a very short clip of time, and so my ex-wife said, you know, I can't do this with you anymore. So I leave. And it's a humbling position to leave and go move back in with family. And at that point in time, I just looked at, I no longer had an alcohol manager. Because, see, I would limit the amount that I let her see me drink to the amount of bitching that I wanted to tolerate at any one given period. And that's when the blackout started. That's when the booze dead started. It's when the combativeness, the violence kind of started. And it's just getting worse and worse. And the attempts on leaving this plane of existence are getting closer and closer together. And after waking up, being comatose for 3 days behind a handle of vodka and a bottle of pills, feeling like a failure because I'm still here and I can't even take myself out, something clicks in my head, and it reminded me to about 13 years earlier when I would hang out in these rooms and people understood exactly what I was going through and I could relate to those people. And it just, a light came on, a glimmer of hope. That window of desperation cracked open a little bit. And so I started looking around for rooms like this. And I wasn't ready, though. I knew there was something in this place. I knew that the people here had a lightness in their heart and a confidence in their soul. And I wanted it, but I wasn't ready to do the work. You know, the book says, through every form of self-deception and experimentation, I will try to prove myself an exception to the rule, therefore non-alcoholic. And I absolutely relate to that statement wholeheartedly. And for me, what it looks like is Alcohol substance A I can't use, and I know that. Alcohol substance B, or alcohol, I can't use, and I know that. But maybe this powder I can try. Or maybe this black tar alcohol I can do. You know, become a recreational heroin user. You know? Just as long as I don't pick up a drink, right? That makes sense. I would hear lingo in these rooms. We have no opinions on outside issues in our readings. And then I would hear people say, oh, hey, that substance you're talking about, that's an outside issue. And somehow my delusional thinking had made the connection that, well, you got no opinion on me snorting some coke because that's an outside issue. And as long as I don't pick up a drink, I can come and hang out here and try to do the thing. Right? I was delusional. All that had to be smashed for me. And until I got all of those reservations out of the way, I really hadn't given myself an honest shot. So I'm trying to come in here and I'm trying to do something because I can see the difference in everybody else. And I'm trying to get there. My soul is starting to awaken and it's screaming for something better. But yet this pain, this internal condition, see, once I put the drink down, that's when the pain starts. That's when it really starts for me, unless I do something else. And I didn't know exactly what that was, and there's no quick fix, you know. And my experience is that I've been weighed in middle of the road AA because a guy wanted to give me his ego and have me show up and call him for 30 days or some shit like that and not take me through solution immediately. Let me share a little bit about what that looks like. You know, that's finally smashed, any reservations, any lurking notions, and I come back to these rooms and I start trying to do this work, and I saw something in a guy that I thought I wanted. I knew I wanted a piece of what he had, whatever it was, and he starts taking me through some of the book, and I don't really understand the concepts because I'm new. And we're going through the reading and I'm not catching it all, and it's not being explained thoroughly, but I'm doing some of the work. But I'm also picking up a lot of BS that we hear in these meetings. And I'm trying to make sense of it all. You know, and I wound up with 4 years abstinence. Thinking I'm doing the deal because I'm going to a meeting every day. And really, I'm just dying inside in these rooms. And I'm talking to this sponsor. And I'm telling him I'm going nuts. I'm going crazy. I don't know what's wrong with me. I'm ready to jump off the bridge. And I never hear, hey, how's the prayer and meditation going? How are you doing on your amends? Maybe you need to sit down and do some more writing. You know, the guy tells me, how about you write out a positive self-affirmation and read that to yourself in the mirror? Maybe you need another 12-step group. And, what that looked like for me is it didn't work. That guy started borrowing some money from me. And we're not talking 20 or 30 bucks or 200 or 300 bucks. We're talking money. And it's set up on this axis where it's sponsee, right? Where he's above me. He's the spiritual guru. And as long as I'm going to a meeting a day, I'm doing this thing for real. And I don't know any better. But I'm coming apart inside. And now I'm resorting back to old behavior. I'm 4 years dry and I'm starting to carry a gun around all the time again. And all I care about is what I ride, who I'm sleeping with, and how I'm sleeping with them. I've got a couple of people that call me their sponsor, but it's an inconvenience for me to go meet with them. And I'm driven by my fear and my delusion and my insecurity and my ego. And I'm ready to jump off the Golden Gate Bridge. And so this gentleman, I cop a resentment behind this, right? And fair enough. And I'm looking at him because he's such a guru. And I don't want to be like him or anyone else like him. And at the same time, I'm in this relationship with this person that I care deeply about. And yet I can't stay faithful in that because I'm bleeding all over the place. I need some sort of solution, and for me acting out can temporarily be a solution. And that's just the honest truth. So that gets found out. That relationship ends. I'm coming apart at the seams, and my ego's too big that I can't reach back out to these people in the rooms. I've spent too much time away from them. And the one person who was my guru is this guy who borrows money from sponsees. And so this resentment almost took me out. One night I find myself sitting at my kitchen table with a half-drinking bottle of whiskey someone I was sleeping with left at my house, and a 9mm. Because I can't keep doing this. I can't live in that pain, right? I'm very grateful that I took that drink that day. That I wasn't part of the no matter what club. Because if I maintained being a part of the don't pick up a drink no matter what club, I wouldn't be here. I would have never found something that I found that set me free in a way that I never thought humanly possible. And so I started to drink, which is actually the most insane act an alcoholic can do. Knowing where it's going to take me, I choose to anesthetize the pain, but what do we expect? That's all I know. And so I pick up a drink and I don't pick up that gun. And that lasts another year and a half. And alcohol finally beats me down into a place of submission one more time. And I can't keep doing this. And the Kaiser doctors are telling me I've got all sorts of things wrong with me. And, you know, it's been my experience that untreated alcoholism looks a lot like post-traumatic stress disorder and anxiety disorder and manic depression and all sorts of other shit that they were telling me was my problem.
Oh, yeah.
And the pills aren't doing it. Nothing's doing it. I knew I got to quit drinking. So I quit drinking again and I come back into these rooms, but I'm not ready to put the pot down. And I sit down with a man who had something I wanted and I knew it because I could feel him walk in the room. And I ask him to show me the work. And he says, well, my experience isn't doing that while you're using this. You know, you got to be clean to get clean. Get your heart clean, your soul clean. And so I step out again. And it's 2 weeks away from alcohol that I'm going nuts again. And that was the last time I put a gun to my head. Because I can't do sobriety without some sort of solution. I just can't. It's my experience. That pain gets too uncomfortable for me. And I continue seeking and, you know, I'll shoot through the rest of that last 6 months. I'm still seeking. I'm starting to pick up some spiritual practices outside of these rooms that have been beautiful when I incorporate them with what I learn in these rooms. And I finally come back in and I'm ready and I'm done. And that guy takes me through the work and I'd like to share some of that experience with you. You know, I understood the mental obsession and the physical allergy. I knew that out of my own experience, that once I put it in my body, that I can't control the outcome of it, the manifestation of craving. And I completely understood that obsessive voice in my head that tells me it's going to make a bad day good and a good day better. I mean, maybe you guys can relate to this. You're uncomfortable. The condition's on you. You walk into the bar. You order a drink. And I don't even need to get that drink in my hands or to my lips. Just ordering it and seeing the bartender start making it. And, oh, fuck. Doctor's opinion talks about men and women drink essentially because we like the effects produced by alcohol. And I can relate to that. They're restless, irritable, and discontent, and unless they can again experience the sense and ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a few drinks. I don't even need to get the drinks in me. I just got to know they're coming. And I start to experience that ease and comfort. You know, and when I stop drinking, that pain starts to come. And what do I do? How do I stop that? Well, this is repeated over and over. Unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there's very little hope for his recovery. Well, how do I do that? How do I inspire a psychic change within myself? Because I don't know how to do that any other way. And that's exactly what a man showed me how to do here. One thing I didn't catch out of the first step before all of my other experiences, because I knew I had the mental obsession, I knew I had the physical allergy, but I didn't catch these mental blank spots. That there's times where I won't be able to bring into my consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering of a day or a week or a month ago. And I could see out of my own experience, as we rolled through this book, the first 164 pages of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I could see that mental blank spot out of my own experience. And as soon as I did, I got scared. I got very scared. Because there is going to come a point in time, a day, where I'm not going to have the memory of all that suffering. And someone's going to pass a substance my way, and I'm going to say, yeah, sure, why not? I'm going to be completely unconscious. And then it's going to start the cycle over again. And I've seen this. And when I had that, when it clicked in my heart, I just thought, excuse my language, but I said, I'm fucked. I am fucked. I have a death sentence over my head that I cannot control. No matter how vigilant I am going to blank out. And I can't see it coming at all. At all. And he's smiling. That sponsor's smiling, going, that's good news. That's good. And I'm like, no, you don't understand. That's not good news. He's going, no, that's great news. So what the fuck are you talking about? He says, no, that's great news because we got a solution for that. And I said, show me. Show me. When I had that understanding, I was willing to do anything. You know, and we roll into the second step. And I had a lot of reservations against God, or a lot of resentment against organized religion. And all it did was ever keep me separated. You know, out of this reading, we read that we have to set aside our beliefs. And until we do, the result is nil. And that means my belief around a source of power. You know, the chapter to the agnostic says twice in two paragraphs, back to back, therefore, when we talk about God, we talk about your own conception of God. And now when the book repeats itself to me, it tells me that it's imperative that I listen. And so it's not my conception of God or Jason's conception of God or Jay's conception of God, it's your own conception of God. And I'm going to leave that conversation there for everyone to find themselves. I had started taking I started getting really into quantum physics. And I'm taking in all this information, and they're explaining universal consciousness and universal intelligence, and quantum physics actually acknowledges that there is a universal consciousness outside of our realm of understanding that observes everything in our perceivable universe at a cellular atomic level. But I never once hear them drop the G word. And so I had convinced myself at one point that there is no God. Well, I come back into this work, and I had been doing more study in that line of thinking, and all of a sudden it all merges in that second step. And really, when we become alcoholics crushed by a self-imposed crisis, we could not postpone or evade. We had to fearlessly face the proposition that either God is everything or else he is nothing. God either is or he isn't. What is your choice to be? And I started weeping, because all I could see was that everything is everything, and it's all interconnected. Consciousness is awareness. And awareness is paying attention. And so there's something paying attention. And I don't have to put a title on it. I don't have to understand it. I just have to be willing to believe that it's there. And then I've got to take some other actions behind it. Try to cultivate some sort of communication with it. And it was profound for me in that moment. And I was ready to keep going. And, you know, fortunately, I had a guy who understood the desperation of alcoholism, and he didn't say, "Hey, your hour's up. I'll see you next week." This is a man who understands that this is a life or death errand for me and saw me having these revolutionary spiritual experiences in real time in front of him. And he said, "Let's keep rolling, brother. Let's get you free." And I tell you what, I can't put a price on that. And it set a very beautiful example of what I want to contribute to other suffering alcoholics. And so we roll into step three, and he explains to me that I'm making a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand him. My will is my thoughts, my life are my actions. And so my thoughts and my actions, I'm going to turn over to this source of power that I've just plugged into. See, I'm powerless around whether or not I will pick up a drink on my own. But I'm not powerless over people, places, and things. And that's just my own experience. If I don't like this place, I have the power to leave and never come back here. If I don't like a person, I have the power and the choice to not interact with them. But out of my own experience, when it comes to alcohol, I lack power. And so I need that power. And so I plugged into something pretty profound. And I'm going to turn my thoughts and my actions over to the care of this source of power. And what that looks like for me when we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer. Being all powerful, he provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. There it is. So you got a new boss, right? New job, new boss. You go out to the job. Are you out there on your first day checking out social media and sitting in the outhouse and loafing around and playing on the phone? First day on the job, you're out there kicking ass and taking names, right? You want to show the boss how impressive you are, how you're needed, your skills are needed in that place. Well, I got a new employer, and that's my job, is to stay close to God and perform his work well. What I do for money, not my job. Where I live, not my job. Girlfriend, no girlfriend, not my job. Believe me, I wouldn't mind that one being my job, but that's not my job. My job is to stay close to God and perform his work well. That's it. It's that simple. This stuff really is simple, but it takes action. And it takes a lot of self-will to get to God's will. You know, God's greatest gift to mankind is the gift of free will. And God's not going to trump his greatest gift to mankind with his will. My God wants me to use my will to get to God's will. And these 12 steps are just a way for me to do that. And so what it looks like is I roll through that prayer, that affirmation of the decision that I've just made. And I line out the inventory, or my sponsor lines out the inventory and what inventories and what that looks like. And my experience with the inventories is that I lose my victimization there. I can't be, you know, I always lived under cause and effect. That you would do something to me and I would be upset by it, and that's cause and effect. Yeah. And in this written inventory, I see that I am causing the effect. And now I can't be a victim anymore because I set all these things into play. My little plans and my designs, my perceptions, my fears, my angers, my desires, my delusions. That's what's driving all of this. I can't sit in that victimship anymore. In fact, I get really uncomfortable when people want to play the victim around me. When it's a sponsee, I'll sit with them just long enough to try to help him see his own truth around that, but then I maybe have to disengage from the conversation for a little while and say, "We'll come back to it." I can't sit in that place of victimship anymore. And we roll into this fifth step experience. I'm admitting to God, to myself, and to another human being the exact nature of my defects. And he did it right out of the book. right out of the book. You know, my experience, I'd read four inventories with three other men prior to this last time coming through the work. And those gentlemen just sat down and said, okay, read me your inventory. All right, let's get through it. All right, good, let's roll, boom. Now, the way the book is written, and I'll share my experience around that with you. The way the book is written here, I just had it because I rolled through it with a guy. It says, until we told someone all their life story. Rolls over here, such parts of our story we tell to someone who will understand yet be unaffected. When we decide who is to hear our story, we waste no time. So the book's very clear in that I do. We have a written inventory and we were prepared for a long talk. So I do the written inventory and then I sit down and I unfold this vast amount of bullshit of a story that I had behind all of this written work. And my experience in that is that all of a sudden I started seeing truth at a new and deeper level that I had never understood before. I got to see that when I do the written inventory, the only thing that's sitting on my conscious awareness is kind of what I remember. But then as I start unfolding all of these years of experience, that it merges. There's this nexus of things coming together, and I get to see that I'd been living lies for decades that I had been telling myself. I didn't even realize it because I had been bullshitting myself. That was a very profound moment for me. What else it looked like for me is, you know, I've heard it explained that the fifth step process is like soul surgery. And that's not to say myself as the sponsor or the man sitting across from me is the surgeon, because I believe the one who has all power is the surgeon. But when I'm sitting there and I'm sharing that time and that space with that man's sharing that time and space for me, he gets to be the scalpel. We get to be the instruments of God, and we get to help other people, help heal them, and help them get free. Because it's God who's really the surgeon. You know, and I had those promises out of the fifth step come true in my life, but it was the first time a man ever held a mirror up for me. And it was a mirror that wasn't clouded by my bullshit, by my plans, my delusions. See, there's perception and perspective. Now I have the perspective because I'm locked inside here and I'm always viewing out. And I can see this way. And I'll give you an illustration here, you know? You look at this book, and I can tell you this is a book. It's got a bunch of patches and some stickers on it. I can tell you there's an AA patch on the front, but nowhere on this book is there a green post-it, because I have the perception of this book. But one thing every man and woman in this room has that I don't have is they're not clouded by my bullshit, my plans, designs. You guys have the perspective. You get the view that I can't see. And you can tell me all day that there's a green post-it on the back of that book. But I can't see it because I'm driven by my own bullshit. And that's what makes this such a magical process, in my opinion. That's where one alcoholic helping another alcoholic find his truth is so important. Because I can't do that myself. I can't get a full view and image of me unless I have someone there helping me. And what happened for me is I got to see myself for the very first time, unclouded. And it was ugly. I didn't like what I saw. I got to see exactly who I had been and what had been driving me. And I was disgusted. I was so ready to have these defects cast out. It was almost uncomfortable to sit for an hour of meditation before running to 6 and 7. But I sat. And something came up. And it was small. And I said, you know what? I'm going to get that guy on the phone. Because if it's small and it's coming up, it doesn't matter. Let's get it out. So I did. And I asked for those defects to be cast out. You know, and that's not something I sit in. I hear a lot of people saying, you know, I'm really taking my time with 6 and 7, and I don't understand it because it's not my experience. We become humbly ready, and we ask. Doesn't seem too difficult to me. Then we roll into 8 and 9. Now that list came out of my inventory, and I knew who I had harmed. As I continue to walk this path, you know, we stand outside meetings, bullshit, share stories with each other, be like, ah, damn, that's another name I gotta add. Because again, I'm unconscious most of the time, and I don't remember everything that I've done, but it does come out. And when it comes out, I add it to the list and I try to clean it up. I've had some very profound experiences cleaning up my wreckage. One thing the guy who showed me how to do this work was, he took me into 10. At the same time, he laid out 8 and 9. He laid out 10 and 11. And I should have grabbed it here. Well, we got a couple of minutes, right? You guys roll with me. This thought brings us to step 10, which suggests we continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. So while I'm rolling through 9 and I'm cleaning up my mistakes, I started working with the disciplines of 10 and 11. And in my experience, I needed that to help me with 9. You know, we get this intuitive sense, and we've always kind of had this intuitive sense. You know, I got a little tongue-tied and I kind of missed it when I was talking about 2 and 3. You know the difference between right and wrong. You know the difference between a truth and a lie, and that's something that's always been with you. That's an intuitive voice. It says deep down in the heart of every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. And to me, that's what it is, that voice that says, hey, that's wrong, don't take that. We've always had that voice, even when we were out drinking and using. It's been there. But I've piled so much garbage on top of it that I can't hear it clearly, and this has been a process to uncover the garbage, so now I can hear it. And now it's louder. And as I'm cleaning up the wreckage of my past and working with these disciplines, how that intuitive voice helps me is I take things into prayer and meditation before I go making amends. And it's that voice that tells me, hey, on this one, do some research, find out if that person's even willing to talk to you. Hey, over on this one, go ahead and make a cold call. And I always run that past another guy on the path. And I've had, as I said, some profound experiences. I'd like to share one with you about that guy who was my sponsor. Because you can believe I did a fair amount of character assassination of that gentleman. Because I had an opinion on how he should be living his life, right? I definitely had an opinion on how he should be living his life. You know, a couple of years ago, I was ready to go sit out front of that guy's kid's school and let him know, hey, I know where your kid goes to school. Am I really the person you want to owe money to? And when I made it to this point in the work, I'm thinking, how am I going to be willing to make that amends? The book tells me to ask for willingness, so I did. Now, I'm not going to say it wasn't sincere, because it was sincere, because I want to be absolutely free. But it was somewhat half-hearted, because I didn't think the willingness was going to come. I said, God, please make me willing. And about 2 weeks' time passed, and all of a sudden I realized one day, you know, I think I'm ready to go tackle that. And so I did. I set up the appointment. And he was actually happy to see me. Guy's probably coming up on 20 years abstinence. We sat down. He afforded me the opportunity, and I was able to clean it up. And at that point, he acknowledged. He says, hey, there may be something on my side of the street. I told him, that's not why I'm here. Absolutely not why I'm here. He says, no, I know. And it went well. I told him, hey, if I can ever be a friend to you, let me know. And that night, when I'm sitting in the review of my day, I was thinking, I want all God's children to be free as I feel, because I'm not carrying anything towards that man anymore. I actually want him to be happy and be prosperous. There's something he acknowledged that he has on his side of the street. What if I were able to help him with that? What is it that's holding it? Is it a dollar sign? If I could remove the dollar sign, because in this situation I have the power to do that, If I could remove that dollar sign, would that create space for him to reach for his own freedom? And I ran that across a couple of men on this path, and the suggestion I got was, why would you rob him of an opportunity at spiritual growth? Let him reach for freedom, and then either forgive it or make him pay it, but let him reach. And guys, I got to tell you, to go from being ready to sit out front of this guy's school, or his kid's school, and be that guy, to now I'm thinking about, what if I call him and tell him forget the debt? Like, that's not Trevor. That's not anything I ever saw myself as. But that's the kind of freedom that I've been given here. You know, and then my sponsor took me through working with others and lined out the direction for working with other alcoholics. And that has really been where a lot of my profound spiritual experiences have been coming from since I've started doing that. Every time I go through this book again with another guy, I see that middle of the road garbage that we all hear get smashed in these pages. And I love it. I love it. You know, I'm sitting with a guy the other day, 64-year-old man. We're reading through the forward to the second edition. We go through the numbers. 50% who came in and really tried got sober at once. Another 25 got sober after some relapses. And this guy starts weeping. And I'm going, what's going on? Are you okay? He says, I can do this. I can do this because you're going to keep doing this with me, and I can do this. And it clicked in my head. This guy's been through 8 treatment centers, and he's hearing all this bullshit that he's got an 8% chance, a 10% chance, a 15% chance of staying permanently sober. And all of a sudden, he sees the real facts and figures of what we can have in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it fills him full of hope. And all of a sudden, my heart just swells, and I start weeping with this guy. And it's like, man, I continue to have these experiences. And you know what? We did a fifth step with that guy yesterday. And I watched another man get free again. And, you know, people come into these rooms, and I've seen it. It's been my experience. It's like they come into the emergency room and they're bleeding. And the doctor says, hey, I'm going to take you in the back and I'm going to stitch you up. And they go, no, I'm good. I'm here. I'm sitting in the emergency room. I'm just going to stop the bleeding. No, we're going to fix you. We're going to get you well. No, that's okay. I'm here. You know, the whole thing about this is a couple of drunks found a solution and a set of spiritual principles to live by, and they deflated their egos enough that they had a desire to go help other people. And now, as a result, 80 years later, I was able to find a path to freedom that I never knew. You know, I can't stay fed off the food that I ate 2 weeks ago, and I don't stay clean off the shower I took a month ago. I got to continue to have these spiritual experiences. You know, to come in these rooms and say, well, I worked the steps, and now we watch people get crunchier and drier along the way because they don't maintain these disciplines. You know, the book says it's easy to let up on the spiritual program. Working with other people and seeing that light come on in their eyes just continues to fill my heart and my soul. You know, it is maybe a little bit selfish. I like to call it enlightened self-interest. It makes me not feel so selfish. Because if I get free and I help you get free, then we're both free and we go grab the next guy and he gets free too. And what I'm starting to see is I'm starting to see guys that I walked this path with are going out and they're getting other guys, and then they're coming back with questions, and man, I am like, fuck. No problem that I have throughout the course of my day could mean shit. Doesn't mean anything. And I watch that come full circle. And it's just, it's just some spiritual principles that we all grew up with. We just didn't have an effective way to put them into, keep it about myself. Spiritual principles that I grew up with that I didn't have an effective way to put into a useful plan of action. You know, I haven't really been paying attention to the time, and I feel like I've kind of been rambling all over the place, but, you know, I want to share with you. This is absolutely my favorite quote out of the book. Like a gaunt prospector, belt drawn in over his last ounce of food, our picks struck gold. Joy at our release from a lifetime of frustration knew no bounds. Father feels he has struck something better than gold. For a time, he may try to hug the new treasure to himself. He may not see at once that he has barely scratched a limitless load which will pay dividends only if he mines it for the rest of his life and insists on giving away the entire product. That's my job. Stay close to God, perform his work well. One alcoholic helping another. You know, I hear it in these rooms more often than I'd like to. Well, there's nothing you can say that's going to get someone drunk, and there's nothing you can say that's going to get them sober. And I understand the concept of that. If someone's not ready, they're not ready. But I also think it's a cop-out that people use to not get off their lazy asses and go out and stick their hand out to the newcomer or be an effective tool and know how to use this book and break these concepts down to the new guy. People who don't want to give up their time to help someone get free. And I think it's crap. I think it's crap. A little bit of self-sacrifice for somebody else. That's what this whole thing is about. You know,
yes.
In there is a solution. Before they even give us the solution, he's talking about going out and working with other drunks. Maybe that's the solution. Maybe it's not making sure I went to a meeting today. Maybe it's how many newcomers did I stick my hand out to? How many new guys have I given my phone number and then called 2-3 days later? You know, I can give new people my number all I want, but unless I get on the horn and call them, they're sick. That phone weighs 800 pounds. They're not going to pick it up. I'm recovered. I'm well. I know better. I can be there at a place to provide them an opportunity to go through this work. That's my job. Stay close to God. Perform his work well. That's it. That's what we're here for. Excuse me. That's what I'm here for. Keep it about me. And as a result, I don't sit in financial fear. I don't sit in depression. I don't sit in uncomfortability, discomfort. Now, don't get me wrong. That shit creeps up. I just had an experience trying to help somebody out. Little financial fear. A potential untreated comes into my house, and I offer her a place for a little bit. Drives me nuts. She starts squatting. And I'm thinking about all sorts of sick stuff. Maybe somebody in these rooms offered to actually do a home. You know what? I'm going to keep that off the table. Keep shifting the thoughts. Not in Trevor's will. God's will. That's not God's will. What do? I do some written inventory behind it. Some prayer. Some meditation. I go meet with my sponsees every day. You know what? The situation worked itself out. I didn't have to create any wreckage. I had to sit in a little bit of discomfort. And I had to trust my God a little more. That's all it was. That's all it was. More faith, more trust, more work. The insurance plan. Nothing will so much ensure immunity from alcohol as intensive work with another alcoholic. You know, we have insurance on our cars. We have medical insurance. You buy an appliance, you get insurance on it. Why don't we see more people out there insuring themselves against another drink? My home group's the 2 or more big book study. It's in this room at 9 a.m. I love that meeting. Now, it's no better, no worse than any other meeting. It's a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous where we tear apart the literature. But what I will tell you is in that meeting, I see new people come in. And I see the gals circle up and get names down on a schedule. And then they go, hey, you go give that to her. And that gal comes up, she's got one day. It's her first day. She said it's her first day in the meeting. And these gals circle around her because they have solution that they can offer her. And they don't let her go sit out and be separated because she's not in the clique. That's absolutely a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that I know in my heart that if someone is coming in and they're struggling with this thing, they're going to get hooked up with multiple people that can offer solution.
Yeah.
And it's not a dumping ground for your problems. You know, what's the message we give these new people if we grab newcomers outside in the parking lot and say, hey, what did you get out of that meeting? Well, it's a good group therapy session. I heard about Joe Bob's divorce. Jimmy Smith's lawnmowers busted. Or did they hear about the love and the power and the grace of God and a solution to get free around their alcoholism? Those are the meetings that I like to be at personally. And that's why I love that meeting. So I hope I get to see you guys all there someday. Thanks.